Our parsha is Be'alotcha. Our parsha begins with the mitzvah of lighting the menorah. And then the parsha speaks about the dedication of the Levim. They're going to have responsibility in guarding the Mishkan and in singing the songs. And the Torah tells us that the Levim start their service at age 25. And at age 50, they shift in their service. We're up to Shlishi. The Torah tells us about bringing the Paschal offering. We're holding the month of Nisan in the second year in the desert, and the Torah tells us about the Paschal offering. People show up, they say, you know, we're defiled, we can't bring the Paschal offering. So they are given, so to speak, the, what's it called, the compensation, no, what do you give someone who doesn't get first prize?
Consolation
prize, right? They get the consolation prize, they get Pesach Sheni. They get to bring the Paschal offering, what's called Pesach Sheni, on the 14th of Iyar, a month after Pesach. We're up to Revi. The Torah tells us about how we would travel, that the cloud would lead us by day and a pillar of fire by night, and we would always wait to see where the cloud was going. That's how we knew where to go. Hashem gives Moshe the mitzvah of making two trumpets of silver, and Hashem tells him how the different ways of blowing would signify whether we're traveling, whether we're calling everyone together, whether we're calling the leaders together. We're up to Chamishi. We start traveling. We come to the desert of Paran. And the Torah describes the order of traveling. And then we encounter Moshe telling his father-in-law, he says, we need you. Stick around. Don't leave. Things are going to be good for the Jewish people. We want you to be a part of it. And the Torah doesn't tell us the end of the story. The Torah just says Moshe asked him not to leave. And then the Torah goes on and doesn't tell us whether he actually stayed or left. Doesn't say. We travel 3 days' journey from Mount Sinai. And now we have the upside down nuns in the Torah. How many books are there in the Torah?
Seven,
he said. Seven, because the book of Bamidbar is considered three books, halachically. Up until the upside down nun is one book. Then in between the two upside down nuns, we have two psukim. They're considered a book in their own right. And then from the second upside down nun to the end of Bamidbar is a third book. So the book of Bamidbar is considered three books.
Those three books have little names or no?
Nope. It's a good point. So the nation starts complaining. They were looking for something to complain about. They're saying, boy, it's been such a long journey, it's been so tough. They were looking for something to complain about. We just discussed that, right? And so a fire comes and starts burning people at the edge of the camp. The nation begs Moshe, Moshe prays, and the fire gets buried on the spot. They name the place Tav'era. Then we come to the Safsuf, which is the Erev Rav. And they desire. And they start crying, and they encourage the Jews to start crying. We want meat. We remember all the fish we had free in Egypt, all the wonderful food we had in Egypt, and now we don't have anything. All we have is this man. So Hashem says, fine, you can have it. And Hashem sends them this bird called the Slav. And people eat the slav, and they get sick, and they die from it. Moshe says, to Ribono Shel Olam, I can't handle this. Hashem tells Moshe, okay, appoint 70 elders. And Moshe appoints 70 elders. The 70 elders go out with him. They receive prophecy. Two people stay in the camp. They don't go outside. They start prophesying. And Yoshua comes to Moshe, he says, you know, they're saying you're going to die, I'm going to be king, this isn't good. Moshe's own son comes running. He says, they're prophesizing in the camp. Yoshua says, put him in jail. Moshe says, what are you so upset about? I wish everyone were prophets. And so Moshe is perfectly fine with this prophecy that Joshua is going to be a great leader. At the end of the story, we hear that Moshe and Aaron are speaking about, Aaron and Miriam are speaking about Moshe and the unusual wife he took, and they say, why does Moshe think he's different than the rest of us? And they're speaking for Moshe's benefit, but they're speaking about him, and so that's called Lashon Hara. And so Hashem punishes them, and Aaron and Miriam both break out with tzaras, and Aaron's teras leaves him and then sticks to Miriam. And Aaron begs Moshe, pray that she should be cured as well. And when Moshe prays, Hashem says, when her father was upset at her as a child, wasn't she embarrassed for 7 days? I'm not less than that. She should wait 7 days and then she'll rejoin the camp. And that's what happens. So there's so much more to discuss about what's going on here. What does that mean, 70 elders? What does that mean they received Moshe's prophecy? What does that mean two people stayed in the camp? What does it mean that Aaron and Miriam were discussing Moshe's private life, his intimate life with his wife? Why did that come up now? All of that we'll discuss as we review the parasha.
Is the 7 days, is that referred to when after Amram got together with his wife and then...
We'll get there, yes, you are correct. Okay, let's begin our parasha again and let's see what's going on. So we have the commandment that when Aaron lights the candles, he has to light all 7 candles. And when the Torah discusses lighting the lamp, the Torah says, Beha'alotcha, Aaron, when you uplift the flame. Why is it termed Beha'alotcha? So one understanding is there had to be steps in front of the menorah. And so there were steps in the temple, and Aaron would walk up the steps to light the menorah. The second understanding is that when Aaron would light the flame, he would leave the candle or the wick, whatever, let's say the match, whatever he was lighting the wicks with, he would leave it by the wick until the flame was lighting on its own, until the flame had caught on to most of the wick. And this is a halacha that's relevant to us every week. When we light Shabbos candles, we're supposed to light the same way, leave the match or the candle by the wick long enough till most of the wick is already lit. And the same thing at Hanukkah candles. When you light Hanukkah candles, you're also supposed to leave the candle there until most of the wick is lit, just like they did in the temple. So that's one thing. When would they light the menorah?
Do you blow the match out, or just leave it there?
On Shabbos, we just put it down on a plate, let it go out. On Shabbos. Okay. That's what women do. Men could really put it out. You could, because men don't necessarily accept Shabbos when they light candles. Then they go and daven mincha and shul. Women usually accept Shabbos when they light the candles, so they should just put down the match on something that's not flammable, obviously. Mm-hmm. When do you light the menorah? What?
18 minutes after candle lighting.
Technically, but once a woman lit candles, the custom is that they accept Shabbos right after they lit the candles. Lighting candles is the final act before Shabbos. 18 minutes is the amount of time we take before sunset to light the candles. We're lighting it before Shabbos, but we're allowed to accept Shabbos before sunset. And the assumption is that when you lit the candles, you accept the Shabbos.
Can you accept Shabbos in the morning?
You can accept Shabbos from Plaga Mincha onward. Plaga Mincha is an hour and a quarter before sunset on a sundial. Now, the way a sundial works is every hour is not 60 minutes necessarily, but rather you take the daylight period and divide it into 12 equal parts. So you take from sunrise to sunset, divide it into 12 equal parts. Sometimes you'll have an hour that's 40 minutes long, sometimes you'll have an hour that's 60 minutes long, sometimes you'll have an hour that's 70 or 80 minutes long. There's no rule on that. That's called shos manios. That's what's called in halacha, shos manios, hours that are really reflective of the daylight hours. And so they're not 60-minute hours. So whenever in halacha we speak about 1 hour or 2 hours or 3 hours into the day or an hour or 2 hours before sunset, what we're really talking about is on a sundial, what's called in halacha shaots maniot.
Is premature self-appointed Shabbos halachically binding?
No. If you accept Shabbos before Plaga Mincha, it has no relevance.
No, not prematurely before sundown. Within Plaga Mincha.
Yes. After Plaga Mincha, if a person accepts Shabbos, he's chayav. That's it. Shabbos is on him. It's like he took a vow to accept Shabbos. It's
and
like a vow.
About the sundown. Wasn't there a group of Hasidim that took in Shabbat an hour after sunset?
Could be. There are all kinds of interesting stories in Jewish history. Could be. You have to remember that in certain locations on planet Earth, for a long time after sunset, you still have a lot of light in the sky. Meaning, if the more northward you go from the equator, you could have places where long after sunset, there's still plenty of light outside. And that could be...
like bonus light. In terms of when the sun's over the horizon, but there's still light. Is that what you're saying?
Sometimes there's a lot of light. Sometimes there's a mountain blocking your view, or there's a building blocking your view. And even though it looks like the sun set, the sun is still out there. And if you look up at the trees, you can see the sun shining on the trees. You know, even the difference between Israel and the United States, the sunset is very different. And even in the United States, different places and different seasons.
From Boston to Florida, Florida is 45 minutes after the United States.
Okay.
So what if you're standing on the mountaintop and you can see the horizon miles further?
Thursday night, you are cordially invited. We can explore all these interesting questions. Back to our parasha. So the kohen would light the menorah. According to many opinions, he would only light it in the evening, like the Torah describes. And then in the morning, he would prepare the wicks. Maimonides is of the opinion that when he would prepare the wicks in the morning, he would relight it, that the kohen would actually light the menorah twice a day, in the evening and in the morning. How many candles does it have? How many? It has six branches and one central beam. So that's a total of seven. That's why the menorah of Hanukkah was made eight. So it wouldn't be identical to the menorah of the temple. We're not allowed to make a menorah that's identical, or any instrument that's identical to the temple instruments. So when they would light it, they would position the wicks so they were all facing inward. And this was an indication of concept number one, that Hashem doesn't really need our light. He's giving us light. He's giving us the sun. He doesn't need our light. It's a mitzvah. It's a way of respecting the Shekhinah, but technically Hashem doesn't need any of this. He gave us a mitzvah, so we position the wicks all facing to the center, because that's an indication that I'm not doing this for the benefit of the light that the menorah would impart. And philosophically, the idea is that in Judaism, you'll always have factions pulling in different directions. So long as everyone's focused on the center, on serving Hashem, then they can all have legitimacy within a range. The menorah was made of one solid piece of gold. It wasn't easy. We discussed on Thursday night that Moshe Rabbeinu went up and down the mountain again and again, telling the Ribbono Shel Olam, I didn't remember, how was I supposed to do this? Until finally either Bezalel figured it out, or Hashem did it on his own, or Hashem told him to throw it into fire and it happened. And that's our menorah. But at the end, you have a very important line. It says, when Aaron was given the task of lighting the menorah, he did it. Why is that so important? Vayas Cain, Aaron did what Moshe said. What's the big deal? The big deal is that human nature is that we always want to leave our mark. In everything we do, we like to leave our own personal, our own mark. If you teach someone how to daven, they will always try to, at some point, stick in their own twist. It happens. It doesn't necessarily happen the first time the person davens, and maybe not the 10th time. But eventually, people within the tunes try to stick in their own twist. People copy a drawing, they try to stick in something that's unique. They're going to improve on the original. In everything we do, we have this human tendency that we want to improve it or drop by adding our own personal, our personality into what we're doing. And that's fine in most areas. But in the temple, you're not allowed to stick in your own twist. Hashem said, this is the service of Hashem. And if you're going to deviate, so then you're already doing your own service. That's not the service of Hashem. That's the great difference between Avodat Hashem and Avodah Zarah. And that's one of the great challenges of a Chozer B'tshuva. Very often you learn Torah, you learn Halacha, and you want to stick in your own thing. You got to find the areas where it's legitimate halachically. There, very often people find areas that are not legitimate, either illegitimate halachically, or illegitimate conceptually, as far as our tradition. So very often, every year or two, we get a ger or chozer b'tshuva who wants to do things like the Rambam. And they're going to insist, I got to do it like the Rambam. And I always question, do you really understand everyone else? Do you have a right to come and say, Rambam was right? I think Rambam's right, yeah? What do you know? By what right do you come out and say Nachmanides was wrong, Tosfos was wrong, Rashi was wrong, Rambam was right? Okay? And then people will say, I'm going to pronounce things like the Yemenites because they got it right. Echad Shema Yisroel. Right? Do you really know? Or is it because you have a drive to have your expression in your performance of mitzvot? Hawayomer, yeah, people are going to make the vavs into wavs. Yeah, I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm saying you have to be realistic. Where is it coming from? It's because we have a drive to find our own expression in the performance of mitzvot. Fine, find your own expression. Feed 5 million poor families. Find your own expression. Be the first one to show up at davening in the morning. Daven with extra kavana. But don't be the one whose tzitzits are flying all over as you're davening because you're garnering this attention as you're flapping everyone in the face. That's not pious. There is a need. Every person wants to feel like they're an individual. And you have to find the venues where you can express that. Be the most perfect Baal Tefillah, the most perfect Baal Kore. But that need to change, to add my mark on it, that's a dangerous need. Yes?
If what you're saying is true, that everyone needs to add their own mark, doesn't that question sort of the validity of all the rabbis that have deemed halacha forever in the past?
The fact that we have this weakness and that we have a drive to express our mark doesn't mean that we don't have a responsibility to overcome it. Part of the responsibility of a person learning and teaching halacha is to be as honest as possible and to be as impartial as possible. It's not an easy responsibility, but the greater a person is, that greatness is first measured by that question. How impartial can he be? Moshe Rabbeinu was the epitome of impartiality, where Moshe Rabbeinu could say, there's nothing here for me. V'nachnu ma. He's just done all the great miracles, taking the Jews out of Egypt, split the sea, and the people come complaining to him, and he says, what do you want from me? What do I have anything to do with this? What did I do? Meaning, everything that's been accomplished, he tells them the man's going to come down, the man comes down. Water's going to come out of a rock, water comes out of a rock. The sea's going to split, the sea splits. And then they come to him with a complaint, and he says, what did I do? What? He was tremendously humble. He didn't take any credit. It's not me. The truth is, it's all Hashem. So back to our parsha. The Levim are now going to be dedicated. So the Levim are coming in place of the firstborn. And they will be responsible for singing in the temple. And be the gatekeepers in the temple. And when they're going to be dedicated, so there's a procession. They have to be sprinkled from the waters of the red heifer. They have to shave off all of their hair. So after that, they will immerse themselves in a mikveh and immerse their clothing in a mikveh and bring a sacrifice. This idea of shaving off all of their hair, what's it coming from? So one understanding is that hair represents the excess in life. Rav Hirsch has a whole piece about how hair represents humility in life. That Hashem gave us hair in parts of our body where we should really be more modest. So the hair covers. The hair reflects a certain shame in one's face, in one's head, in one's private parts. But in general, we assume hair represents excess. And there's another idea in hair. And that is that when a person becomes defiled with the defilement of tzaras, part of the purification process is they have to shave off all their hair. And then they immerse, they bring their sacrifices, they become pure. And being that the Levites were coming in place of the firstborns, and why were the firstborns disqualified? Because they had pursued the egel, the golden calf, and idol worship is considered like it defiles a person. So the Levites that are coming in place of the firstborns who went after paganism, part of their process of purifying themselves to be able to come instead of the firstborns is shaving off their hair. And from this evolved a custom, which was acceptable even in the days of the Shulchan Aruch, and up until this century, people would adhere to this custom. And that was if a person decided, a religious Jew decided, he is now going to become a Christian. So he spends a year or two, he does the stint adhering to the Christian beliefs. And then he comes back and says, I want to do tshuva. I changed my mind, I want to become a law-abiding Jew. So then the custom was we wouldn't accept him back into a minyan, into a shul, until he shaved off all his hair and went to mikvah. Now there's no halacha that way. It says it in Shulchan Aruch. But it says it because of this custom. Based on this pasuk, the Levites had to shave off their hair and immerse themselves after going the pagan ways, or after coming instead of the firstborns who went the pagan ways, so to any other Jew who went the pagan ways would have to first shave off their hair, immerse in mikveh, and only then he would be accepted as one of ten in a minyan. And this custom is quoted both in the halachas of Gir and in the halachas of Chol HaMoed, where it says on Chol HaMoed, ordinarily we're not allowed to take a haircut, but being that this Jew won't be able to be a part of a minyan, we permit him to take a haircut even on Chol HaMoed to adhere to this custom. It's quoted in the laws of Gir because up until this century, the custom was that a ger would also shave off all their hair before they go to mikvah. And that's why some batidin till today will ask a convert to take a close haircut before they go to mikvah. The Rabbanut does not do this. I've yet to hear of the Rabbanut asking a person to take a close haircut. But this is a custom that's quoted in Shulchan Aruch in the Ramah in Ilchot Giyur, and it stems from this halacha. Yes, Amir.
Sorry, but this whole shaving, maybe think about this connection also with, we're just going to talk about Pesach, Pesach Sheni, and the Nazir. And then it's kind of Nazir, he's not drinking wine. So he doesn't drink wine on Pesach, he gives up the mitzvah of drinking wine. Thursday night.
Right, Thursday night. Yes. We generally assume drinking wine is Durabanan on Pesach and Shabbos, correct? We generally assume Durabanan, yes. You have to make Kiddush, that's Doraita, but you can make Kiddush on other things, right? He would use Hamar Medina. He would use Hamar Medina, the local beverage. Could use. Back to our parasha. So the Levites are appointed and they're waived. That's an interesting thing to Nufa. They lifted them and waived them. It's interesting, right? He's an 80-year-old man, 81 years old. And he's lifting all these Levites. But we see that in the book of Joshua, Kalev was 85, and he tells Joshua, he says to Yoshua, I'm as fit as I was back when I was 40. I could take on all those giants and I'll clear out Hebron for you. Leave it to me. So you see, in those days, people were very fit at the age of 80 and 85. The fact that by 120, Moshe was fit as a king, that was a miracle. But 80 and 85, it seems, I don't know. Okay, back to our parsha. So, the Torah says that the Levites would do their service at age 25. In another place, the Torah says at age 30. So there's a Gemara in Tractate Chulin. Gemara says as follows. It's the bottom of page Chaf Dalet Amar Aleph. The Gemara says, why does it say age 25 and age 30? To tell us, at age 25, they would start learning the job, and at age 30, they would go on site and start doing it. Mikan, says the Gemara, from here we can infer, letalmid shelo ra'a siman yafe b'mishnato chamesh shanim, a student who spent 5 years learning in yeshiva, and he learned Mishnah, and he should already know part of it by heart, and he doesn't yet. After 5 years, you could figure out that after 5 years of learning Mishnayos, if you don't know some of it by heart, if you don't get it, you're not going to get it. That's the time you should give yourself to check it out. Rashi says, what does it mean? Shelo rasi man yafe lomed v'shochecho. If you keep forgetting, yeah? If you keep forgetting. If you learn Mishnah and you can't retain what you learned, so you learn the same tractate 300, 400 times and you don't remember, so then you're just not cut out for it. But most people don't spend 5 years learning Mishnah. 400 times. Oh, you could start with 400 times. Doesn't mean you end with 400 times. There are tractates that I learned over 100 times and I still forget and I still haven't given up on myself. There's an interesting Gemara in Tractate Shabbos. The Gemara in Tractate Shabbos in the second chapter says the following. It says, if a person is respectful of the sages, then he will have children who are sages. If he loves this, if he loves the rabbis, then he will have children, or here we go. The Gemara in...
Something about
Brachos, if someone does something good, they'll have kids that are sages. Right. So it says, if a person is respectful of the rabbis, then he himself will be a learned person. Ve'ilav barachihu. But if he's not capable of being a learned person, mishtamin mile kitzur b'mirabana. Nonetheless, people will listen to him as though he were learned. So that line in Talmud seems to say that there are people who are not worthy, there are people who can't succeed in learning Torah. What does Rashi say on that line? Rashi says, "Sheino ragil la'asok b'Torah." What does that mean? He's not worthy. He's not capable of succeeding in Torah because he's not constantly trying. Rashi says, you want to know who the Gemara was talking about? Who is it, that guy who, even though he's so respectful of the rabbis, he can't become a rabbi himself? It's the guy who doesn't try. Rashi seems to say, if you're going to try, you can get there. The question is, are you going to continue trying? Sheino ragil la'asok b'Torah. If you don't consistently try delving and dealing in Torah, then you can't get there. There's no shortcut. You got to work hard. Back to our parsha. So the Levites worked 5 years in preparation, and at age 30 they'd start the service. And that teaches us that you got to give yourself 5 years in yeshiva to see if you could really retain information, if you can catch on to the learning. Okay, we're up to Shlishi, and the Torah suddenly takes us back, because the beginning of the book of Bamidbar was already in the middle of the second year in the desert. And now, here, the beginning of the book of Bamidbar is in the month of Iyar in the second year in the desert. And now, suddenly, three parshios in, we're going back to Nisan, we're going back a month. This is the proof of a concept which we have throughout the Torah, and that is, Ein mukdam u'mu'chal b'Torah. The Torah is not necessarily written in chronological order. There's a machlokas, Nachmanides and the Ibn Ezra. Do we say that wherever we feel like it? Can we say that wherever it seems to make sense to us as commentaries? Or do you only say it where the sages told you this is written out of order? That's an argument throughout the Torah between Nachmanides and Ibn Ezra. So they bring the Paschal offering. And here the Torah is really giving a hidden rebuke, because it was the only Paschal offering they will bring throughout the 40 years in the desert. So what's wrong with that? Why is it the only Paschal offering? Because there was a situation where in order to retain those clouds around the Jewish people, they couldn't have wind. So Hashem prevented a wind from blowing. Now the stagnant air caused a certain mold. You had certain stagnant air around the Jewish camp because you didn't have a breeze. And so the Jewish people would ask their local Orthodox rabbi, am I supposed to circumcise my son when the air is stagnant? And the rabbi's answer would be, you don't have to, and you're not prohibited from doing it. It's up to you. There is a certain intrinsic risk, and under such circumstance, the halacha does not obligate you to circumcise, nor does it prohibit you from circumcising. Meaning, sometimes the halacha says, this is dangerous, you're not allowed to do it. Sometimes the halacha says, this isn't dangerous, you got to do the mitzvah. And sometimes the halacha says, it depends on how dedicated you are. You're not prohibited from doing it, you're not obligated to do it. It's up to you. I'm not going to tell you either way. You can say, I'm concerned, I'm not doing the mitzvah, and you're within your rights. You can say, I'm not concerned, I have a mitzvah, and I'm going to be okay. You're within your rights. You cannot say, I'm not concerned, I'm going to do the mitzvah, even though the child's hemophiliac, and chances are he's going to bleed to death. It's a mitzvah, let me circumcise him. That's wrong. Prohibited. You cannot say the child had two siblings that inexplicably dropped dead after their circumcision, but I'm not worried, it's a mitzvah. You're not allowed to do that. You cannot say we checked the child and the doctors recommend waiting, but I'm confident, it's a mitzvah, everything will be okay. That's prohibited. We respect the doctors, we listen to the doctors. But sometimes the answer is inconclusive. The medical answer is inconclusive, and so the halachic answer is inconclusive. And that's where the Jews were for 38 years in the desert. They were in a situation where the medical knowledge said there is a slightly greater risk to circumcise now, but it's not greater to the extent where we say you're not allowed to circumcise. You're allowed to take certain risks. We do take certain risks. We take certain medications. We know there are side effects. We know there are certain risks, and there are risks we take in life. The question is it worth it for us? And that's where it depends on a person's level. We all take risks. You go bungee jumping, they make you sign on it, because some people do die. You go mountain climbing, they make you sign on it. Your child wants to go on a class trip, they make you sign on it. There are many things we do in life that we know there's a certain risk involved, and we do it. You sign up for online banking, they make you sign that you know your funds are in accordance with the contract, and you hope that no one's going to do identity theft on you, right? There's a certain amount they're covering you, and there's a certain amount they're not. So we take risks when it's worthwhile for us. Sometimes the halacha says it's up to you. Sometimes the halacha is conclusive, and sometimes the halacha says you decide. Is it worth your risk or not? Now, when we'll come after the 120, they might tell us, wait a second, didn't you do the equivalent? Didn't you take equivalent risks for other things that were not really important in your life? You know, if a person constantly drives over the speed limit, yet circumcising his son in the desert, he says, gee, it's risky, I really shouldn't do it. Then why do you drive quickly? How come when you're in a rush, you're willing to take that risk, and yet when it comes to circumcising your son, you're not? So it's a question of how important it was to you. So our inconsistencies in life come back to stare us in the face after 120. But that's why this is considered the shame of the Jewish people. Because only the tribe of Levi would circumcise in the desert. Here we see their dedication to Hashem. The tribe of Levi said, it's going to be okay, and they circumcised. No one else did. The rest of Israel said, it's dangerous, we don't do that. And our sages say this reflected badly upon us, because it was that middle ground where it was legitimate if we would have done it, and it was legitimate if we didn't do it. But it reflected on us that we didn't do it. Okay? Yes?
Where do you find that source of Levites to that?
I think it's in the Gemara. I think it's in the Gemara that the tribe of Levi circumcised. I think the Gemara in Tractate Yevamos, I'm pretty sure. I think so.
Is there any way you can find that answer?
I think I could, yeah. If you email me. Remind me, yeah. I'm not Matzi Shabbos. That's when I might have time to look it up. Yeah. Say that. Simcha. Okay. So there are people who say Lama Nigara. There are people who walk up and say, we don't want to be left out. And we have that twice in the Torah. People who say, we don't want to be left out. Once over here, and once with the daughters of Tzlafchat at the end of the book of Bamidbar. They say, we don't want to be left out. We want a portion in the land of Israel. My father-in-law always says this over, that in life, when it comes to spiritual things, a person should say, we don't want to be left out. That's a rule in life. I think I found it. Give me 1 second. I'll make Mr. Dudling happy. Let's see if it's here. There's a chapter in Tractate Yevamos called He'orel. The chapter discusses a Kohen who is not circumcised because his siblings all died from circumcision. So we don't circumcise him. So that chapter is called He'orel. Okay, Gemara Yevamos, page 72a. The Gemara says, all 40 years we were in the desert, there was never a northern wind. Give me 1 second. Let's see, where is it? I'm in the wrong place. Why didn't they circumcise in the desert? The Gemara asks. Either because traveling made them weak, or because they did not have the northern wind. Why didn't they have northern wind? One understanding is because they didn't want the clouds to scatter. Um, Yeah, Tanane Kavod. Okay, I'm not seeing it here. I'm not seeing it here that the tribe of Levi did circumcise. I don't see it here, but I remember it does say that. So I have to find where. Okay, I don't know. I have to find it.
Oh, it's very well known that Levi was a circumcised the answer was
Ve'et banav lo yada. The Talmud says it on the pasuk Ve'et banav lo yada, that Levi made believe he didn't know his own children, and that's a reference to the fact that he agreed to circumcise them. Ve'et banav lo yada. But I have to find where. Right.
Maybe there is written something
that. No, I don't think so. Okay, I have to find it. Kisha merim ratecha uveritecha yinsoru. And that the Gemara dashens it. And that, what it says about the tribe of Levi. But I have to find it. I'm not seeing it here. I didn't remember this page. I just saw it in Nachmanides as we were talking. I didn't remember. No, in all honesty, I did not remember. Okay, onward. Okay, so they get the second paschal offering. Now we're up to Revi. We have a description that the cloud would fold and then it would signify that they're ready to go, and it would wait for Moshe's approval, blowing the trumpets, and then they would go. Moshe has two solid silver trumpets. We're traveling, and we reach the... Moshe speaks to his father-in-law, and he says to him, we want you with us, and I want you guys to pay close attention to what goes on here, because the Yalkut Shimoni brings us an interesting medrash here, and I think that the medrash is relevant to everyone's own life. I think that every Chozer B'tshuva and Ger undergoes what happens here with Yisro. Yisro wants to go back to his family. And he says to his son-in-law Moshe, he says, let me go. I want to convert everyone. I want to tell everyone about Judaism. I want to tell everyone how great God is. And Moshe says to him, please don't go. And if you won't listen to my pleading, to my request, then I will command you not to leave. If you leave, then the Jewish people will say that you didn't really convert out of love for Hashem, but you thought you'd get a benefit, because now that you heard that the converts don't get a portion in the land of Israel, you don't have a set portion. Each tribe gets their set portion. And everyone will think that's why you left. So that's one pshat. But it's the second pshat I wanted. It says that Yisro said, I got to go. I got to go convert my family. I got to go convert my community. And Moshe says to him, Kasavul she'atam arbe kvoda makom. You think you're going to make greater honor for Hashem? Ve'enata ela mime'et. And you should know you're doing the exact opposite. You want to go back home and teach everyone? You should know you're going to accomplish the opposite. Kama gerim va'avadim ata atid le'achnis tachat kanfei ha'shchina. How much do you think you'll accomplish by going home? How many people do you think you'll convert? How many servants? How many friends? How many people will you bring under the wings of the Shechina? Vayita lanu le'inayim. But if you stick around, you will be an example for everyone. Because what's going to happen? Future converts will look at you. And what will they say? If Jethro, whose son-in-law was the king, he didn't live up to it. He packed out after a period. How much more so the rest of us can't hack it? Look at what people are going to say if you leave. You have to stick around, and then you will be a sign for the world. Very often when a person converts, so their first inclination after tshuva or giyur, let me go back home and tell everyone how great this is. And Moshe is alluding to another point. He's alluding to Yisro, something which he doesn't say overtly. He doesn't tell him, you know, if you go back, you're going to lose everything. He says it in a roundabout way. He says, what are people going to say? The father-in-law of the king couldn't hack it. He went back. What does that mean, he couldn't hack it? But Jethro's saying, I'll go back, I'll convert everyone and bring them here. And Moshe's telling him, it's not going to work. Stick around here. This is where you can be a beacon of light to the world. Here, build a life, build a family, show people that you can keep the Torah and Mitzvot as part of Klal Yisrael. Don't think you can go back and change the world. You're going to go back, and Moshe doesn't say it overtly. He's very smart. Moshe doesn't need my compliments, right? Moshe says, people will say, you couldn't hack it. What does that mean, you couldn't hack it? Because if you go back, one thing will lead to another. Before you convince them, they'll convince you. Even if you won't be convinced, the influence, the idea of going back, well, where will it leave you? You don't have a Jewish community. You don't have a Jewish day school for your kids. You don't have the system. How are you going to manage?
Moshe's kids went back with him.
Who said?
I thought Yisro went back. No?
Well, there are two opinions among our sages, whether Yisro stuck around, whether he listened to Moshe or he didn't.
Oh.
The Pasuk doesn't say.
Oh, right.
So one opinion says he packed out. And that opinion says that the reason Yisro packed out, he made a mistake in judgment, but it was part of Hashem's doing. Hashem said, with all due respect to him, what did he do to deserve this? My children slaved in Egypt for 400 or 210 years. And Yisro waltzes in, having lived in the lap of luxury all this time, and now he's going to be a part of all this? So Yisro had a big yetzer hara to leave, because he hadn't sweat enough to merit being a part of what was going on. And Moshe pleads with him. He says, I know you think you'll accomplish. I'm telling you, you'll accomplish more by sticking around. And according to one opinion among our sages, Yisro doesn't listen. And it's Hashem that gave him that Yetzer Hara, because Hashem says, what's going on here? By what right? Today, it's the opposite. A Jew that's born into Judaism has it easy. And a person that comes to convert has to do all this hard work to become a part of it. But nonetheless, I think the Midrash is revealing to us one of the great yetzer hara of a person after he does conversion. There's this tremendous desire to go back where you came from. And it's coded with this desire to proselytize, which is not a Jewish thing. We're not really looking to convert anyone else. But it really is the downfall of many great people. We've seen it here in the Machon. Most people who go back, like Moshe warns Yisro in this roundabout way, he doesn't say it overtly, they have a very hard time, if ever, coming back here. It's just difficult. It's difficult. Yes?
You use the word commence. What does that mean?
Commence to begin.
Commence or commence?
I don't know. I don't remember where I used it. Yes?
Do we know who's the Parshan, who was the companion that he did, went back and backed out and abandoned everything?
It's a Medrash Rabbah.
Medrash Rabbah?
Yeah.
There's another opinion that he did go back but didn't leave Judaism?
Yes. There are Midrashim and Rishonim, because we find that Yisro's descendants were given Jericho and for 400 years. Till we built the temple, and then the tribe of Benjamin got the bounty of Jericho. But for 400 years, Jethro's descendants stayed in Jericho. It was prohibited to rebuild Jericho. They stayed there and lived in tents there and enjoyed all the wonderful fruits of Jericho. Jericho was known as Yericho, it says in Yosifun, in Josephus, because out in the Mediterranean, you could smell the sweet fruits of Jericho. That's why it's called Yericho, from the word reach, smell. So the fruits of Jericho were so delicious, you could smell them miles away. And those fruits were given to Yisro's descendants. The Jewish people had decided that whichever tribe would take it upon themselves to build the temple in their territory would receive as a reward the bounty of Jericho. And until that time, they gave it as a gift to Jethro's descendants. His descendants, in fact, became part of the Sanhedrin, part of the High Court of Israel. And they were around till the destruction of the first temple. And the prophet Jeremiah tells the Jewish people, learn from the descendants of Jethro. Look at how careful they are. They don't drink wine. They don't live in houses. And that's kept them humble. And that's kept them in line with the Torah. So Yisro's descendants, in fact, are excellent Jews throughout Jewish history, throughout the period of the first temple. Well, I don't know. The Druzes say they're the Druzes, but Chazal say that they became full-fledged Jews and leaders of the Jewish people. And that's what Moshe is foretelling Yisro when he says, you will be our eyes. He's telling him, you have the potential to have descendants who will be the leaders of the Jewish people, which in fact came true. His descendants were the disciples of Asniel ben Kenaz, the Shofet, the great leader of the Jewish people, and they were part of the high court. Okay, we're going to skip to the end of the parasha. So we have the whole story with the Slav, and then Moshe says, I can't take this, and I need help. And Hashem says, okay, take 70 elders. So step number one, prophecy. How does it work? Prophecy is when a person perfects their traits and they reach a level where they have control, and now Hashem is they're going to connect with Hashem, they're going to have prophetic vision. So how does it work that they're going to get Moshe's prophecy? So the Ran tells us an interesting point. The Ran says, prophecy can work on overflow. If I stand next to someone else who merits prophecy, even if I don't deserve it, by the mere fact that I'm next to them, it can resonate. I can get prophecy too. And this is an important concept in all of life. Sometimes being next to someone who's great can make me great, even though I'm not worthy of it. There's, so to speak, an overflow. My uncle told me an idea which is interesting, and I've seen it borne out throughout world history. He said that he's noticed that whenever an invention comes down to the world, it comes down to a few people at the same time. Did you guys know that at the same time the Wright brothers were working on developing an airplane down the block from them, only a few miles away? The United States government had commissioned a scientist and a whole team to develop an airplane. Wow. The Wright brothers did it first with a budget that was like a poultry compared to the budget of the American government. But at the same time, there were two people working on the same thing. At the same time that we were working in the United States, the Allies, to develop a tape recorder, the Germans had developed a tape recorder. At the same time that Kodak was developing the camera, Eastman developed the camera, right? That famous lawsuit between Eastman and Kodak. Throughout world history, you see that ideas come down at the same time. This is what my uncle told me once. So it's as though from heaven, they give down this idea, and now the question is, who's going to go off with it? Who's going to develop it? So coming back to prophecy, when Hashem gives down prophecy, our sages say, very often prophecy comes down to all the prophets at the same time. Very often all the prophets will see the same vision, but only one is given the commandment to tell it over. Or only a few are given the commandment to tell it over. But many will see the same vision. It's not as though only one prophet will see the vision. Very often, many will see it. There happened once that there were 250 false prophets standing opposite Jeremiah, and they all said, Ba'ele tenagach et Aram, with these horns you will defeat the Aramean army. And Jeremiah standing there, and he says, they're all liars. So the Judean king asks him, how do you know? And he says, look, I don't have to have the same vision of prophecy as they do. Could be they got prophecy that I did not receive. But I know one thing. Ein shnei nevi'im mitnabim b'signon echad. Two prophets cannot say the same words of prophecy. Even if we all saw the same vision, the wording is going to be a personal wording. That's why Jeremiah, who is thrown into prophecy at a young age and he never learns proper grammar, so his prophecy is filled with grammatical fixes of Kri Ktiv that Barbanel explains in the introduction. And that's why in the Navi Yechezkel, you see wording that you don't see in the prophet Yoshua, because the language evolved, and the prophet Ezekiel is expressing the prophecy in his words. So the prophetic vision is going to be expressed based on the prophet. And that's the tradition we have. No two prophets can express the same prophecy the same way, even though they might all see the same vision. But if 250 people are standing saying the same line, so Jeremiah stands opposite them and he tells the king, they're all liars. It could be they saw a vision I didn't. But the fact that they're using the same wording is a clear indicator they're all liars. So Moshe is given a prophecy. And Hashem tells Moshe, I will give you 70 helpers. And the concern, as the Ran explains, is that when you have a democracy, then you have danger. Everyone could pull in the other direction. The Roman Empire's democracy was its downfall. They could not respond efficiently to the threats that were coming, as we see in the United States. They're having a very difficult time throughout the United States and Europe dealing with the Muslim threat because they're a democracy. So the Muslims can take advantage of the weakness of democracy. There's no question that the best form of government is a monarchy if you can ensure that the monarch is knowledgeable and kind. The challenge is that you can't ensure that. And so the monarch takes advantage of the power, and democracy is a good compromise that will ensure that the humans can protect themselves from the cruel monarch. But that's because you can't ensure you're going to have a good king. But if you could have a good king, so then he could take all the benefits of democracy. He could take the counsel of every expert in every field. He can do everything right. He can try to do everything right, and he can be efficient. And he could take people and appoint them to different positions and ensure that the job gets done. But that's if you have a kind and ethical and noble monarch, which is hard to find, right? As they say, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely, right? So there's a problem with that. So that's why democracy is a good compromise. But when you have Moshe Rabbeinu as king, so then you're in a pretty good place, right? Can't get better than that. And then Hashem tells him, you could have 70 people. You need help, I'll give you 70 people. So then there's a danger. You're going to have a democracy now. You're losing all the benefits of having Moshe run the show. Hashem says, no. They will all get their prophecy through you. When they stand next to you, then it's as though your prophecy expands over all of them. And that will ensure that you all work in the same system. It's not that they all come up with their own ideas and now you have 70 people pulling in 70 directions. So how do you choose 70 people out of 12 tribes? Right? 70 divided by 12 is how much? Well, each tribe can submit six people with two extra, right? So they said, okay, we'll draw lots. Every tribe will submit six great leaders, and we'll draw 70. All 72 people will come forward. Two will get a blank. Everyone else will get a prophet. And those two will stay in the camp. The 70 will go out of the camp. Okay, so 70 people go out of the camp, but two of them have white slips, and they walked out with everyone else because no one knew who got the white slips. So Eldad and Medad got slips that said prophet, but they saw 70 standing outside the camp. So Eldad and Medad say, okay, we'll stay in the camp. Moshe goes out of the camp, Hashem gives him prophecy, and the prophecy spreads to the 70 people, including the two who are not worthy. And Eldad and Medad inside the camp. Along comes Moshe's son and says, Moshe, Dad, there's a danger. Now you have two prophets who are walking around prophesizing irrespective of you. This is what you were worried about, a democracy. Now you're suddenly going to have two other leaders competing with you. Two prophets are standing inside the camp, and they are individually standing there saying that you, he doesn't even tell his father what they're saying. They're saying Moshe will die, and Yeshua will lead the Jewish people. This is the worst threat, right? We were concerned that when you have 70 other leaders, 70 other prophets, you could pull in every direction. Here you have two new people who seemingly were not part of the camp. They were not part of the 70, and their prophecy is saying exactly that. Moshe is going to die, and there's going to be a new leader named Joshua. Here you have the roots of a rebellion. It's about to begin. They didn't mean any harm. They were saying what God told them. What does Yeshua right away say? Put him in prison, right? Yeshua is fighting for his Rebbe's honor. He doesn't want the honor. He doesn't want the dangers of these two prophets. He says, Moshe, put them responsible over the public welfare. They'll give him a bunch of mitzvahs to perform. And if you want a surefire way to ensure that people don't grow in spirituality, make them responsible for mitzvahs. If they're responsible for the public good, they won't have a free minute to work on their traits, to learn Torah. They'll be swamped with the being do-gooders for the public. Don't worry, they'll never have prophecy again. It's a food for thought. Sometimes we want to be do-gooders, and it's good to be a do-gooder, but your time in yeshiva, you got to take advantage to learn. If you're going to be focused on volunteering everywhere, you're never going to grow in your Torah. You need to take time to grow in Torah, and that's what Yeshua tells Moshe. Give them a lot of public responsibility, and they'll disappear. You won't have a problem. They'll never get prophecy again. And Moshe says, you worried about me? I want everyone to be prophets. Miriam is standing outside the camp, and she's standing next to Moshe's wife. And Moshe's wife witnesses as 70 people start getting prophecy. So Moshe's wife says, gee, I feel bad for their wives. Tzipora says to Miriam, and Miriam says, why? So Tzipora says, well, I know you guys all think we're married, but ever since Moshe went up to that mountaintop, when he comes home, his bed is on one side of the tent, and my bed is on the other side of the tent, and he hasn't touched me ever since he got that great prophetic vision on Mount Sinai. So Tzipora is married to the greatest prophet of all times, but Moshe is so humble that Tzipora thinks that he's like everyone else. So she thinks if they all got prophecy from Moshe, must be they're all going to separate from their wives too. So Miriam says, gee, really? Moshe hasn't touched you in all this time? She runs over to the big brother Aaron, and she says, Aaron, there's a problem in Moshe's tent. He hasn't touched his wife in a year. Ever since he received the Torah at Sinai, Aaron, you got prophecy. Did you leave your wife? Aaron says, no. Miriam says, neither did I. I've been with my husband. You've been with your wife. We're living like normal human beings. Why is Moshe being different than us? In Moshe's greatness, in his great humility, his own siblings think they're just like him. And here they were talking as older siblings. They're both older than him. Out of concern for Moshe's welfare. And they spoke privately. They weren't telling anyone else. But they were doing something they shouldn't have done. We don't have time, sorry. They were doing something they shouldn't have done. They were talking about Moshe. And they began with the supposition that they are equal to Moshe. And very often when we speak Lashon Hara, part of our mistake is that we speak about someone else as though we understand where they are. So what Hashem does is he suddenly calls Moshe, Aaron, Miriam. He says, please come out now, I want to talk to you. So Moshe comes out of the camp, and Aaron and Miriam had just been with their spouses a few hours earlier, and they hadn't gone to mikveh yet. They weren't pure enough to receive prophecy, so under normal circumstance, Hashem wouldn't have spoken to them. But here Hashem was teaching them a lesson. Now when a person suddenly gets great spirituality, but they're not ready for it, so their body reacts, and that's what happens. Aaron and Miriam both break out in leprosy. Their bodies turn white. They're half dead. And God says, I want to talk to you now. And Aaron and Miriam both say, God, we can't handle it. We need a mikvah. We can't. And Hashem says, no, let's talk now. You were talking about Moshe. And Aaron and Miriam are both standing there yelling, we need water. We can't handle this. We're totally defiled. We're not fit for this. And Hashem says, if there's any other prophet on planet Earth, he sees a vision. When I speak to Moshe, it's face to face. Moshe sees exactly what I'm saying without a vision. He knows which words to say. Every word in Torah is my word. Any other prophet sees a vision, and then, as we discussed earlier, they use their wording to pass over that vision. How dare you? Why weren't you scared of talking about my Moshe, my servant Moshe? And Hashem's anger expresses itself, and they're both breaking out in tzaras. And Aaron is spared because the initiator of the conversation was Miriam. And so Aaron's tzaras goes over to Miriam. And Aaron and Miriam quickly run over to Moshe. Moshe says, I forgive you. And he turns to Hashem and he says, I've forgiven them. Hashem, please heal her. She's my sister. Aaron turns to Moshe and he says, she's a part of our flesh and blood. Won't you pray for her? Moshe says, of course I will. Hashem says to Moshe, back when she was a kid, she told her father he would give birth to the leader of the Jewish people, and you were born. And for 3 months they celebrated what a brilliant daughter she was. And then they saw they couldn't get away from the Egyptians. And even though there was reason to assume that the Egyptian decree would be annulled when you were born, it didn't happen. The decree was not annulled. Even though the Egyptians saw that they didn't succeed in drowning the leader of the Jewish people and the stars, they didn't annul their decree. And then when they were forced to put you in that Nile, when they were at that juncture, her father spat at her and tapped her on the head and said, where's your prophecy now, Miriam? Here we celebrated you for 3 months and we don't see it. It isn't happening. And she was so embarrassed for 7 days she kept the distance from her father. So now I was upset at her. Shouldn't she have the same decency 7 days? From here we learn the concept of Kal Vachomer, and from here we also learn the concept of Dayo Labam and Adin, which maybe we'll have time to discuss on Thursday night. Now we're out of time.